are listening to the Europhone Radio Network, and this is the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show with your host, Andrew Carrington Hitchcock.
Hello, everybody. Returning with me today is Tom Metzger. Now, last time I had Tom on, I had some complaints because, as you know, Tom was formerly Identity, and I am Identity, and we discussed that, and Tom explained why I wasn't Identity, and some of the Identity followers felt I should have questioned him on that issue. But I knew of Tom's beliefs before I called him and asked him to do a show, but he's done so much for the white race that it's not an issue that was going to come between us. I obviously respect Identity people because I'm one myself, but I think the race issue is the most important one. And so today the subject of our show is going to be racial unity. So I'm going to bring Tom up right now. Tom, are you with me?
I'm with you, Andy.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining me again. We've got all sorts of things to talk about. I've still got some questions from the last show that we didn't get through. I've got on a piece of paper here. Maurice Deese, he once said that you were the most dangerous man in America. How did you feel about that?
Well, Maurice Deese is always full of crap. Yeah. If I'm the most dangerous guy in America, we're in big trouble.
Well, I think Kissinger said that Eustace Mullins was as well. So they always seem to have anyone that's pro-white race is a danger to them.
Well, I'm an ideological terrorist. That's what he doesn't like. He knows I'm not a physical bomb thrower and all that kind of stuff. But what he does know that I am into propaganda and what I call ideological terrorism. And so it's my thoughts that bother Maurice Deese more than any actions. He would love it if I would go out on the street corner and yell and scream and wave a flag and put on a uniform. He'd love that. But he doesn't want to talk about me because I work silently behind the scenes and underground and so forth.
Well, that's the whole purpose of Resist.com and the whole purpose of the lone wolf theory that you developed.
Yes, it is. And that's something that they don't want to talk about because it scares the bejesus out of them. They know that whether it's ideological or intellectual or radical or whether it's, doing something really bad, lone wolf works. And no matter what you want to do for the white race, you can do it better with lone wolf.
Yeah, and I actually just, what we discussed before the show, I was talking to Mike Walsh, a show I did with him, and he was involved in all these groups. He took over a British nationalist group in 1974 when Colin Jordan was arrested, and they all ran to him to take it over. So he took it over. He was forced into the position. It was the timing that made the man. He never saw himself as a leader or a writer. But he said, Andy, the thing is, in all these groups, he says, what you always find, it doesn't matter where it is, you'll get 10 people, and I guarantee one of them will be an infiltrator.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. At least one. and probably it's the leader in many cases. I mean, look at all the guys that are in prison because their right-hand man or their chief of security was a rat for the system.
Yeah, I mean, people like Frank Collin, American Nazi Party or something, and I think he turned out to be Jewish or something as well.
Jewish pedophile. He went to jail for pedophile stuff, too. So I knew he was a Jew way back. I tried to tell people, but the right wing have a problem, I know, in this country, that you can dig up the facts on something, and then if they don't like what you're telling them, they don't want to listen to you, or they ignore you, or they attack you. Like I knew a young man in California who was going to a college out there. This is years ago, and he was talking about the Holocaust and revisionism, and the Jews wanted to persecute him, and the JDL Jewish Defense League threatened to attack him. So I took my men up to the college to protect him, and we did, and the JDL never got to him. Well, later on, he went off the tracks and was arrested for child molestation. And everybody went all excited, and all the right wing said, oh, he's innocent. The Jews set him up, set him up, set him up. Well, the Jews can set people up. Anybody can set people up. But I said, why don't you go down and get the paperwork on the case at the city hall? And nobody had. So I went down and got the paperwork, and indeed he was charged with 9 counts of child molestation, and he pled guilty to 5. Now, if in this country you don't plead guilty to child molestation unless you don't think there's, well, you just don't do it because it's going to haunt you for the rest of your life. It's on your record. And so I reported that to the right wing, and they went crazy attacking me. I said, wait a minute. You wanted to know for sure. You thought the Jews set him up. The Jews didn't set him up at all. He did it, and he's guilty of it, and he pled guilty. But they've never forgiven me for that. That's how silly the right wing in this country gets.
Well, I mean, it's a standard white race thing, isn't it? I remember, you know, when I was working a job, and there was a pub that people used to go to at lunchtime. And I didn't like drinking at lunchtime, so I'd only have like a soft drink. But there were these two older guys, and they both quite well qualified and what have you, and they do the Times crossword together. They did it every lunchtime. They got the Times crossword out. It's quite a difficult crossword. And then they'd, you know, get most of it and stuff. But then you try and tell them about, you know, pretty much everything that they believe is false.
Yeah.
quite a real story about 9/11. But because they're, like, in their 60s now, they don't want to admit that everything that they believed has been wrong.
Yeah.
Because they would feel like a personal failure as a result. So rather than just saying, you know, appreciating the fact that they can open their eyes and see the real truth, they'd rather not see it because it would upset them that they feel that they wasted their life.
Right. But I'm talking about people that should know that have been in the struggle for quite some time. I mean, the man on the street's got some excuse, but these people in basically the right wing end of it, they have no excuse. And you still tell them what's going on, and they don't want to believe you. So anyhow, if it rains, the Jews caused it. If the price of bread goes up, the Jews caused it. Everything's the Jews. They go on and on. It's all I can think about is the Jews. And like I've said, and like this fellow Walsh has said, you know, that our biggest enemy is ourselves, the white race. And we opened it, you know, like in the Dracula movies, you have to open the door and let the vampire in. He can't come in unless you open the door. And that's what the white race has done for all these years and all through history. We've opened the doors for the vampire Jew, and he's come on in, and then you blame the Jew. I mean, the Jew does what Jews do, sort of like joke about the squirrel that was going to go across the river, and he had a tarantula or something on his back. And the tarantula said, I need a ride across the river, and the squirrel said, you, tarantula, I'm not taking you across, you'll sting me and I'll die. And he said, oh, no, I wouldn't do that. And they argued for a while. He said, oh, well, okay, get on my back. So they get out in the middle of the river, and the tarantula stings him. And the squirrel said, why would you do that? We're both going to drown. He goes, that's my nature. So anyhow, that's predatory Jews. I mean, you know, there's tame. Rockwell's talked about tame Jews, and there's tame Jews. And, of course, Jews are not, we argue about this all the time too, Jews are not a race, and they're not classed as a race, but people keep, they would love to be a race, but they're not. They mostly are hodgepodge of people who have married into other races. The worst damage they do is marrying into other races, and so you find Chinese Jews, black Jews, you know, the Jews in all the races. And that's their power. They can subvert from inside the race.
Yeah, and do you know the worst thing about being a black Jew, Tom?
What's that?
You have to sit at the back of the oven.
Oh, jeez. Oh, man. And I thought I was bad.
Sorry, you set that one up for me.
Yeah, right. I never heard of it. It is new. I never heard it before.
Oh, okay. It's a good one. But, yeah, especially when both of those things, the Holocaust, we know, is false, and the idea of that woman having to go to the back of the bus being a seamstress, we know she was actually a secretary
of
that communist organization over there, that Rosa Parks.
NAACP.
Yeah, that's it. And, yeah.
Well, wait a minute, though. I was going to say something there, and I think it may have escaped me. There was no Holocaust, but there were a lot of Jews died. You see, the trouble is they got us biting on this false history thing. They got us to accept the term Holocaust. See, they invent the word Holocaust, then they say what it means, and then they argue with everybody else about what it means, and what it means is that it's just a word. And the trouble with a lot of people, they try to say, there was no Jews killed in World War II. The hell there weren't. There were tons of Jews killed in Eastern Europe by the Russians, too, you know. So just say, well, that happened. That's war. 55 million people died in World War II. What you bitching about?
I think that's the issue that people have, because whichever way you look at it, the 6 million Jew figure is false. That's widely inflated.
Of course. But
even if that was correct, how about why don't we remember the other 49 million?
Yeah, that's right. Well, and also I say, wait a minute, World War I was full of Jewish capitalist predators raping Germany, and after World War I, and then you get pissed off because the German people turned on you. However, I do have the suspicion, and I think I can back it up, that there was a two-pronged thing. One was the people who wanted to get rid of Jews, period, and the other ones that wanted to get them out and just get them over to Palestine, and that's why Hitler signed a pact with the Zionists to in Eastern Europe to get the Jews out. There were 3 million Jews in Israel before the hostilities really got going. So I think Hitler was schizophrenic, or he wanted them out of the country. But the trouble is, the most assimilated Jews in Europe were the German Jews, and the most highly educated were in Germany. And a lot of these people had a Jew in the family 10 generations back, but yet they were picked up and shipped to a concentration camp. I believe Hitler's policy on the Jews in Germany was wrong, totally wrong. I believe that these people who had assimilated and looked German, looked Aryan, talked Aryan, acted Aryan, were loyal Aryans, should have been allowed to give a pledge of loyalty and go about their business.
Well, there was that book, and it was written by a Jew, and it was about the Mischling, apparently Hitler's 150,000 German Jewish soldiers, and there were some Jews that he was making honorary Aryans. So this whole aspect of history is very, very confusing, because, of course, you've got what you just said about, you know, any Jew blood was, you know, 10 generations back, they were off to a concentration camp. But then you've got other people coming out and saying that there was 150,000 soldiers that were part Jewish fighting for Germany. And then you've got stories about Hitler making some Jews honorary Aryans. So it gets very cloudy.
Well, no, they're not stories. They're facts. I've got all kinds of that stuff in my files here. And so Hitler had a very strange fixation on the Jews. And, I mean, some of the Jews were some of his best friends, and coming up in his career, he had a lot of Jew friends, and there were only about 50,000 Jews in the Wehrmacht, not 150,000. But one of his top generals, I forgot his name, was Jewish. So, if he'd have played it like Stalin did, he'd have been better off. Stalin played it this way. If you were a good Jew, a tame Jew, a loyal Jew, and followed my orders and didn't give me any trouble, you're okay. And they pin a great Russian hero badge on you. But if you crossed Stalin, he sent you off and executed you. So if he could use the Jews, he used them. And if they gave him any trouble, he'd kill them.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing is that I think that they had the last laugh, didn't they? Because there's, you know, there's stories that he was actually killed by them anyway.
Yeah.
They were the people that made him ill, and of course, was it Khrushchev who succeeded him?
Or have I got that wrong? I'm not quite sure now, but it was the so-called doctor's plot.
Yeah.
Beria was in on it, and all these guys, and so we don't know for sure what happened there, but it's very logical that he was getting sick anyhow, and they wanted to get him out of the way. He had to have been really sick for them to try to kill him or kill him, because they knew if they failed, then they'd be in worse shape than the ones that tried to kill Hitler.
Yeah, I just went on to the wiki page, and Stalin was in office from 1922 to 1952, and it was Khrushchev who succeeded him. Yeah, exactly. Well, we'll go back to your, let me see, going back to the Morris Dees thing. Now, there was some civil suit that was filed against you that, you know, the sort of Jewish groups always jumping up and down celebrating like it's a day of Purim for them. Can you give us any information as to what really went down there?
Well, what went down there was he saw that I was the sort of the up-and-coming guy in this country on the race issue, and I was getting tremendous amount of media attention, and we were on all the television shows around the country over and over again, my son and myself, and Dees figured to target me. And so what happened was, there was these three black guys up in Portland, and three white guys in the middle of the night got into a confrontation in a street over the vehicle passing. The black's car was blocking the road, and so there was a fight. And in the fight, one black got killed. And interestingly enough, he was half a block away going into his house when the fight broke out, and he set his beer bottle down and ran back to get in the fight, and so he was killed. Well, that went on. That was a big news story, but it had nothing to do with me. So the press went wild. They started having marches in the street because these were three skinheads involved. And so there was one guy that had gone from Southern California. He had been with us, but we kicked him out, David Mazzella. And he knew about the killing, but he wasn't there. He wasn't a witness or anything. And he came down to Southern California and started going to the parties where the skinheads were, and he ran into my son and my son-in-law, and we knew that he'd been a snitch up there. And so we don't like snitches. So at the party, he got roughed up. Not hurt bad, but roughed up. So he got mad and called the ADL and told him the story, and that he was involved up there in Portland. And then the ADL put him in touch with Morris Dees. Then Morris Dees picked him up, took him down to his palatial mansion down there in Georgia or Alabama, and wined and dined him and told him he was going to make a movie out of him, and he took him out deep sea fishing, going, all this kind of stuff. And so he was putty in the hands. And so whatever Morris Dees said, he said, oh, yeah, that's true, that's true, that's true. So he was the heart of the case against me that tied me to those guys in Portland, which I never met and never knew. He was at a party one time, and he called my house, and he said, I want you to meet somebody. And it was one of these guys, and he got on the phone. I said, hi. He said, hi, and that was it. That's my only contact with anybody in Portland. So anyhow, now it's getting into a national story. So I go out to hire attorneys. I didn't have the money to hire an attorney, and the only attorneys that would take my case wanted $100,000 cash up front. There was no way I could do that. I had a house, a very modest house, but they had that locked up too, so I couldn't borrow money on it. So I didn't have any legal representation. So we decided the only thing we could do was handle the case ourselves, my son and I. And we'd never been to law school, and we watched a little Perry Mason, but that's about it. So here we go, two totally legal neophytes into this court with 10 or 12 lawyers and all kinds of people in Dee's team on the other side, and we're having to argue this case. And everybody's against us, and they're marching in the streets. They had guards on the roof with machine guns, and every day we'd go into court, there would be SWAT teams there with machine guns, and the jury people was going in right beside us, so they pictured us as homicidal maniacs. And we had nothing to do whatsoever with that situation. So anyhow, we did the best we could, and I thought it was pretty good. Incidentally, we've got hours of that trial. Whoop.
Oh,
you went
oh,
off.
Oh, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm hearing something happening
yeah.
there.
Yeah, well, I heard a little pop, but I can still hear you, so don't worry about
okay.
that. I don't know what that was.
So anyhow, trial went on for weeks. The ACLU wouldn't even help us, American Civil Liberties Union. And so it went to the jury, and one person on the jury said not guilty, or it wasn't guilty because it wasn't a criminal offense. It was a civil offense that what we did caused this all this stuff to happen, which was ridiculous. We had a black judge who was falling asleep half the time. That didn't help anything. So anyhow, it was like shooting fish in a barrel. Imagine yourself being confronted with something like that, a major national case, all the media was there and everything else, and you didn't have an attorney. I mean, and since it was a civil trial, I couldn't get a free attorney. If it had been criminal, I could have got free attorneys. But so here we are doing the best we can, and of course after the trial, Dee said we only did that to show off, and the right wing picked that up. A lot of right wingers that didn't like me picked up on that and said, well, Metzger was just showing off. Showing off, hell, I'd have rather eaten glass and go through that trial.
Yeah.
So anyhow, they got me for what, $6 or $7 million? You know, which we laughed about. John and I were in the other room playing cards. And we knew what was going to happen. We knew they were going to find us responsible. So we're out there, and the cops are out there, the guards are out there, and we're laughing. They said, what are you laughing about? They're going to get you for millions. We knew what was going to happen when we got into this thing. We knew they were going to find against us, so the hell with it. Not going to stop us, because they're not going to get $6 million. They're not going to even get $100 million. So anyhow, we had the conviction. We went back to Southern California and started putting out the newspaper just like we'd always done. We didn't quit anything. And Dee's thought he had me really out of the picture by now. And we never were out of the picture. And that's what's funny, because he doesn't talk much about the Metzgers. He's embarrassed by the Metzgers, because the Metzgers were the only people in this struggle had ever fought him to a draw. That we never said, Uncle, I could have made a deal. My son could have. We could have made a deal and not had any problems, but we didn't make a deal. We fought him all the way, even when we had no attorneys or anything else. So anyhow, it's anybody who studies the real heart of the trial and all the testimony and what we were up against defending ourselves will come away understanding we were totally set up. Totally. Even the cops, we subpoenaed cops that knew the whole story, and they lied. Four or five cops. And yeah, so anyhow, it was just a street fight. Technically, it didn't have anything to do with race, even though they were black guys and white guys against each other. It was guys that they'd all been drinking, I think, and it was over a traffic incident. And so anyhow, that's the way it goes. When you fight the system, you either have to fight them all the way or get out of the kitchen.
Well, I think the important point is, you see, Dee's and that lot will all say, oh, we got, you know, $6 million lawsuit against the Metzgers, and we won, and they lost everything and all that. But the fact is, you didn't lose anything. You just carried on with your life, because you can't, you know, get blood out of a turnip, as well, you said to me before. And, you know, so in the end, you didn't suffer as a result.
Well, now, I won't say that. We lost a house, the house that we'd had for 20 years and 30 years. My wife was sick with cancer, and she died in the meantime. And and then they did have a judgment against us where they got some money over the next few years, but not a lot. And so we had losses. We had to leave our house and get into an apartment and try to do my business from an apartment and just to make a living, you know. So I threw them a curve because I said, well, you want to steal my money unjudiciously? I'll take your money. So I applied for welfare right away. I said, I'm going on welfare like all the Negroes. So for there several years, I received welfare checks. And I don't apologize for it either because it was my payback for them screwing me, you know.
Well, I mean, you know, it was all lies in the court. And, yeah, it was just that. The whole idea, obviously, behind it was that if we can beat the Mexicans, we can beat anybody, and so that puts anyone off.
The only thing that gives me long-term angst is the fact that almost none of the right wing or the Klan or anybody supported us. I mean, I'm not even talking about money. They didn't even give us publical support. I mean, there was Robert Miles did. Richard Butler of Aryan Nations, he supported us, and a few other people. But beyond that, we didn't get any support from the so-called right-wing racial struggle. And so that's why I don't get along with much of the right wing today, because they're hypocrites and cowards, and when it comes down to the wire, they'll screw you.
Well, I mean, I remember you know, call people out to actually go and tend one of our right-wing people's graves, you know, the people that have gone before, or things like that. Just map out where these different heroes of our race are buried, and actually go and visit and look after it and things like that. But people just don't seem to care.
No, they don't. And that's why the right wing is, I think the right wing is over myself. I think we have to go in a different direction, racial but different direction. That's why I've been swinging a lot to some of the left, because I like their anti-war positions, and I like their environmental positions, and I like things like that. I don't like their racial positions and like that. I think we could do better recruiting young people from out of the so-called left. The right has just been a failure for a long, long time, and I don't want to spend the rest of my life screwing with a struggle that uses old tactics, old habits. They continually lose. They don't understand the big picture. They don't understand world politics. They don't study. And a good share of them are losers. I'm sorry. That's just the way it is.
I think that there's been this sort of, you know, period. I'm hoping that now there's some younger people coming through that, you know, seem to, you know, there's this alt-right movement that's sprung up, and there's a lot of nationalism in that, and there seems to be a lot of people keen to be bringing out different work, and you know, I'm hoping that will be a resurgence that it needs. But I think earlier on,
wait a minute, it's impossible for these young people to get it straight because they have to work through this old line right wing crap, pro war, let's go kill everybody that. Our country, this or that, instead of our race and like that. They've got all kinds of excuses not to do what they should do. And so these young people, they come in, but they don't have a chance because they don't get educated properly. I mean, there's, you know, most of the people in the right wing are pro-war. I mean, you know, fratricidal war has killed more white people than anything else. I mean, the whole idea, I go through the history of, I think the revolution was wrong. I think that the First World War was wrong. The Second World War was wrong. All of this is fratricide, but the right wing, in most cases, support that kind of crap to where thousands of white people are dying and white young people are dying. And I'm anti-war. Anybody wants to call me chicken, well, I'll pop them in the nose and they'll find out how chicken. You see, way back, people forget that during the Vietnam War, I refused to pay my income taxes because of the war. All these people, young white people being killed over there in Southeast Asia for nothing. So yeah. I quit paying my taxes. The IRS, the federal people, seized my house once. I got it back. In fact, they seized it twice, and I got it back. But here I am, you know. I didn't want to march in the streets with a lot of these people that were against the war, but I surely was against the war, and I've been against these wars ever since.
Yeah, and I mean, earlier on, I remember hearing you on the show, and you were saying that you might get a call from someone at 2 a.m, and they say, look, Tom, we really need your help, and you just get up and you drive a couple of hours and go and see what they needed. But that kind of you know, brotherhood and willingness to help one another that was back in the 60s and 70s, that kind of dwindled since.
Well, it's just not there. I mean, it was even bad back in the old days.
What years are you talking about where there was at least some sort of willingness to help each other? I mean, is that the 60s and 70s? I mean, when did it really...
Well, it was always just a few people that were willing to help other people. It was never the whole struggle. One thing that we did, and that was before I even got into the racial struggle, was the fact that the federals were and states were seizing property from anti-tax people, and they would go out to auction off their property and their businesses. So we put together, oh, maybe 50 people in Southern California, and every time they went out to sell a person's house or his business for taxes, we'd go out and surround the house and sing patriotic songs to where the sheriff and the people couldn't auction the house off. They'd just have to leave. So that was one tactic that worked for us early on. That was the one time when people would come together. But I found in the Klan or in the National Socialists or in all these groups, they don't really back each other up. I mean, there's a few. There's a few core fanatical people. But look at Rockwell. He ends up being shot by his own man. Joe Tomasi was shot by another National Socialist. And so I think there's been a false flag element in the right wing all along. And I call a spade a spade. I mean, we got to study tactics and international politics and finance and all that and take it to the street. Going out and rolling around in the gutter with a bunch of progressives, crazies, is a waste of time. I tell the guys in Britain, I've told them before, attack the city of London. Don't go around with rolling around in a gutter with other working people that are just deluded, you know. Let's take the fight to the real enemy and quit playing around, or don't take it at all. I mean, the city of London, the banking system in England is killing the British people, and yet the right and left are out in the street rolling around and punching each other, you know. Bullshit, attack the system.
Yeah. I mean, really, this kind of brings us to the racial unity issue that I've got some other bits to go through, but let's jump onto that now since it's led right into it. What, you know, we started off this show talking about, you know, religious beliefs. So what you're really saying, we leave the religious beliefs to one side, we leave the political beliefs to one side, and we use what should unify us, which is our race.
Whatever hurts the enemy is what we use.
Yeah.
And we haven't been hurting the enemy hardly at all. I mean, there's not enough of us, and there's too many people that are off on sidetracks, and they're never going to hurt the enemy. It's a sad situation because I've spent a lot of money, which I didn't really have because I was, you know, Morris Dees said I took in $250,000 a year. That was the biggest joke in the world. My wife was even laughing about it. We never took in over $25,000 in all the time I was in business. And I was putting all kinds of my money, even though I didn't have much money, into the struggle. So, and donations, that's a joke in the right wing.
Yeah, that's very true.
They need their money for beer, you know.
Yeah, you won't get very far in this struggle with a donate button, folks. So I do want to thank people that have donated, but yeah.
And the people, they don't back up people in prison. They don't write them. They don't send them any money. They don't do anything for them. There's a few that do. Now, I pick out a few deserving POWs. Some of them were the order with Bob Matthews, and I send them money every month. I send them books. I send them cards. I send them letters. I send them political information to keep them up to date on what's going on in the Middle East and wherever it's at and all that kind of stuff. But most of them, if a guy goes to prison for his race in this country, forget it. He's not going to get hardly anybody supporting him. You know, the lowest common nigger killer in the country has got all kinds of people. The welfare mothers of these niggers, they send them all kinds of money into prison. I just was talking to one of the POWs I send money to, a good friend, and he said, you know, you got to see these blacks in here. They get all kinds of money from their welfare wives, and, you know, a white racial guy in prison gets peanuts.
Yeah. And, as I say, it's a sad state of affairs. I mean, and it basically justifies the position that you've taken is based upon the experiences that you've had. And then we talked earlier in the show about groups of people and how infiltration is very easy. And that's why it's always been difficult. I mean, for example, let's take Hal Turner as a case in point. I mean, you were on his show. I remember I once, he had something, how do I explain it? It was before Christmas one year, forget when it was, and he said, I'm just going to say to people, but I'm going to put an advert for whatever your organisation is on the side of my sign if, you know, you send me a donation. It can be any amount of money. And so I sent him, asked if he'd advertise my book, and this was while I was still, I'd just printed 500 copies of my own, and, you know, so it was just that sort of era. It had only just been out about a year. And then I worked out what I'd taken. I just assumed all my sales in that period. I benefit of the doubt, I assumed that it was all because people had gone to Hal Turner's site. Obviously, it all wouldn't have all been. But I think in the end, I sent him something like 20% of that, which is about $30. So I wasn't selling a lot of books. But technically, people would say, oh, you were on Hal Turner's site, so you're a bad guy too. You were on Hal Turner's radio network, so you're a bad guy too. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Well, I found him out after a while. I mean, you know, we all thought that was a good idea in the beginning because he seemed to me legitimate, and so we go to things like that and try to make them work until we find out they're not right, and then we leave and we don't do it anymore. So anyhow, you couldn't be criticized for that just because you wanted him to advertise a book. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying, there will be people out there that it is ridiculous, but that's what some people would do.
Well, that's what's wrong with the right wing. Let me tell you, Andy, I walked away from the right wing 20 years ago, but they still haven't got the message.
Yeah.
I said, I'm not putting up with this shit anymore. We're going a different direction. And I'm not going to go to your rallies. I'm not going to go to your song fests and your beer clutches. And I'm not going to march around like an idiot. I'm not going to put on a uniform. I'm not going to wave flags. We're going to figure ways behind the scenes to hurt the enemy. And I'm not going to play this game. I mean, they're always asking me to go some rally someplace and speak. And I say, what for? You guys never learned. You're going to do the same thing over and over again. You never defeat anybody. Or they come out and support some ridiculous program. It means nothing. I mean, you know. So I got so tired of it. You know, I insult them any time I get the chance because they deserve to be insulted because they're misleading hundreds, maybe thousands of young people that could be great soldiers if they knew what to do and do the right thing. But having big band concerts and drinking beer and yelling Sieg Heil all the time, that changes nothing except makes it worse.
Yeah, I mean, just on the Hal Turner issue, I mean, in your opinion, do you think he was a bad guy from the off, or do you think his head was turned, or he was bribed, or whatever?
He was a con man from the beginning. He's always been a con man, but he was able to hide it and come across. These con men are very good, or they wouldn't make any money. I mean, you're the number one con man in this country, and I don't care who's going to get mad at me. It was David Duke. I've known him forever, and he's a con man. And he gets some people ghostwriting books and stuff like that. But he has been associated with some of the worst people you'd ever know. But I knew him from the very beginning. And he's riding on the shirt tails of this Ronald Trump deal. Now he jumped in there to get his name in the paper. And if he really had been for Trump, he wouldn't have made a connection. So, because it's hurting Trump. If you like Trump, Duke is really trying to hurt him. But he don't care because he just wants the publicity. But nobody, I don't think there's 1 in 10 right-wingers out there who are going to believe me. They're going to say, oh, you're just jealous of David Duke. Well, I know my files are so full of stuff on Duke, I haven't even released it all. But I don't care. I just want him to fade out. But I don't think he's going to fade out. He's going to play this game forever.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing all the different facets to the right or whatever and the racial struggle.
Well, you can get away. If you're a leader in the right wing, you can get away with anything. I mean, he blew $250,000 of the members' money. He tried to sell the Klan at one time. He was gambling down on the Mississippi. He did all, and he had one of the top pornographers in the United States working for him in his managing his office. That came out just not too long ago that he, one of his other buddies was a big drug dealer. I mean, I can go on and on. But you tell people that, and they say, oh, you're just jealous. David's such a wonderful guy because he's such a good bullshitter. Go ahead. Yeah. All I can tell you is Bob Matthews had him on the list to be knocked off. That tells you something. If you like Bob Matthews and the Order, they had a list drawn up of about a dozen people to be knocked off, and he was one of them. But they got caught before they got the job done.
Bob Matthews was the... Yeah, they were caught. They were some sort of bank robbery type thing, wasn't it, in the 80s?
Bob Matthews was the father of the second American Revolution. Bob Matthews was a great man, and all his men, all his men in the Order, and a lot of them are still in prison, are my friends. That was the only real thing in the last 40, 50 years that the right wing ever did right, and he was doing a great job, and he would have been still gone if he hadn't trusted too many right wingers. He went around trying to recruit more people. He should have stayed small in a cell type deal. He had about 6 guys that he could really trust, and he should have kept it that way, and then developed lone wolf cells all over the country. But he sent some guys out. He was a little bit naive on some things, And they went out around the country recruiting these right wingers to be in the Order. Well, they weren't dependable people. They were disloyal, and some of them just got into it to get the money that they had robbed.
Can you give just a background for people that don't know the story of the Order? And also, it leads us into a funny story about the Oliver Stone film Talk Radio, which was based upon Alan Berg. They were... Showing how bad the Order was on there, and the actor in that actually playing the Berg character, although he's not called that, he's called someone else, but it's clearly based on that. He gets shot by this evil white man at the end, and they like to ramp that up, and I know you actually bumped into that actor on a plane, and I think he fled. But if you can just give us a bit of background for people that are unaware of what the Order did, how they were formed, just briefly.
Well, the Order was formed because they had given up on the right wing. That was the reason the Order was formed. They knew the right wing was going nowhere. They were doing nothing. They were eating meat and retreating. They were going to rallies, doing all this bullshit. It didn't change anything. And so that's what drove Bob Matthews, who was a rancher up there in Idaho, to form the order. And they called all these few these guys together, half a dozen of them, and they organized what they called the Bruderschweigen. And their job was to bring it to the enemy. I mean, really bring it to the enemy. And so they went out and started doing that. And they hit that Brinks truck for $3 million, and not very much of it ever got recovered either. And they were almost into the big vault in San Francisco where they kept all the gold. They almost knocked that over. And if they'd have got that and got out of the country, they'd have been fixed. But anyhow, so they started taking it to the enemy, and which had never been done by the right wing. And so they really were not right wingers, as far as I'm concerned. They were Revolutionary Guards, as far as I'm concerned. And I'll tell you, these right wingers immediately went against Bob Matthews and attacked him. One of the big right wing leaders in the South said that he was working for the CIA, and these different leaders attacked. There was only a few guys above ground that supported the order. I was one. Richard Butler was one of Aryan Nations. Robert Miles, his Mountain Church in Michigan. And I guess there was a couple of other guys. But other than that, the rest of the right wing were attacking him. Oh, he's crazy. He's going to get us all in trouble. Oh, well, you've been in trouble for decades. You've been in trouble for 100 years. So he set out to do something about it. And I'm sad as hell that he got killed, burnt alive by your wonderful feds. They didn't let him wait him out, and so they set the place on fire and killed him. I support them, and I still support them, and it's sad because some of his followers, soldiers, are still in prison, and they can't get parole because they're racist, and they won't bow to the enemy and say, I'm not a racist. If they said, I've changed my mind and so forth, I've become a liberal or something, they'd let him out of prison. But Richard Scutari, they recently were going to have a parole hearing for him, but he had to say, I've changed and I'm not a racist anymore. And he told him, no, I'm a racist. And so he's going to do another 10 years after doing 30. And so when they get the real people in prison that are in this struggle, they keep them in there forever or kill them.
Well, Tom, are you familiar with the... it was William Pierce, but under the name Andrew McDonald. Not the Turner Diaries, but the other book, Hunter.
Yes, I like Hunter. Hunter's great. I didn't like the other one because it talked about dropping atomic bombs and stuff. And I don't believe in that. In fact, I don't believe in the bombing stuff anyhow, because that's a dirty way to fight a war.
Well, in the reason I say this is I actually got hold of the first edition copy of Hunter, and I had a second edition, and it was well worth getting because there's one page missing that they took out from the first edition. So it's in the first edition, but all subsequent editions it's not there. And it says at the very start of the book, dedicated to Joseph Paul Franklin, the lone hunter who saw his duty as a white man and did what a responsible son of his race must do to the best of his ability and without regard for the personal consequences.
Well, that's in my copy, too, and I like that. He was quite a guy and technically a role model for a revolutionary. I mean, unfortunately, he wasted himself on low-level targets. That's the problem. Just going around shooting lone Negroes on the street and stuff like that, that's not the way you fight a revolution, you know. Now, to be perfectly honest, you got to do it like the anarchists at the turn of the century. They went to the top. You read about the anarchists at the turn of the last century. They didn't fool around at the bottom. They went to the top. And, of course, if you're ever going to really solve a problem, you got to go to the top.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you mean. And of course, I've just got his page up, and he was killing sort of interracial couples and things like that.
Well, we all agree that that's a very nasty thing, this race mixing stuff. But the point is, when you're a small group or an individual and you don't have hardly any power, you can't waste what power you have on low-level struggle. You've got to retain your power against the higher levels, you know. I'm not going to go much farther because I know you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, on that note, we can move to, because we've only got a few minutes left.
Sure.
What should we go through? Obviously, you met, the actor was Eric Bogosian from Talk Radio, and he knew who you were, and you knew who he was, and I think, what happened there on a plane? You bumped into each other.
Well, I was flying back to New York to do a show, and a TV show, I don't know who it was, but it was one of the big ones. Well, anyhow, I got on the plane in San Diego, or maybe L.A., and as I walked back the aisle, I spotted him, and he spotted me, and so I sat down just a couple of rows behind him. And I could see he was sweating all the way to New York. He was sweating all the way to New York. He was fidgeting around in his seat and everything, you know. Because they believe their own media that we're homicidal maniacs. Of course, they believe that stuff. Well, yeah. Sure, sometimes we have to take care of business, but for the most part, we're not going to do something stupid, you know, like, what am I going to do to him on the airplane, you know?
Yeah, that's it. But, the other thing that you mentioned on another show that I heard that people might not be aware of is Wesley Swift, the famous identity pastor, was actually started off as a driver for Gerald L.K. Smith.
Correct. I didn't know him personally because I came on the identity scene after he had died, but I knew his wife quite well. Of course, Bertrand Comparé, they lived down there. His wife and Bertrand Comparé lived in the same area of San Diego, so I got with them several times. In fact, Bertrand Comparé and I, we had a little church thing right in his house while him and his wife were still alive. Yeah. In fact, he presented me with a brand new .357 Magnum pistol, and he said, "Tom, they used to present warriors with swords, but we're going to present you with a .357."
You've still got it, and you haven't fired it to this day.
It's never been fired, no, and I'll never fire it.
Yeah, that's wonderful, and and then the other things I've got on here is obviously you met Farrakhan. Was that when you spoke in Harlem? And what was the feelings between the two of you? Was there any common ground on the basis that he wants racial separation and you want racial separation?
Well, some of the National Alliance people had made contacts with the with Farrakhan's people and black separatists in Washington D.C. and they told me about it. And I said, well, put me in touch with their guy there, I forget his name now, but anyhow, he was a black guy.
Eliza Muhammad or something?
That was the guy who started the whole thing in Chicago. This was...
Okay.
Yeah, anyhow, I said, anyhow, tell him I'd like to get together with them, and so they with me and said, Farrakhan's going to have a big major meeting out there at an auditorium in Los Angeles, and we're going to invite you. And so I said, fine, I want to come. And so I took about five of my best men, and of course we always went around in suits like Farrakhan's people. I mean, not with bow ties and stuff, because we believed in dressing up. This crap of going around looking like a bum is not a good way to represent the white race. So anyhow, we go up there and their security puts us in a special location. There's 20,000 people at this thing, and there was only 10 of us white guys. I mean, if they wanted to get us, they could have smashed us very easily. But anyhow, they cordoned off a special section. And they went through their speeches, and at the end they were asking for donations. And I told my security man, I said, take this $100 bill up there and give them a donation. And he did, and they all clapped. The 20,000 people clapped for the white Aryan resistance. They were all black. So anyhow, it took the media about a week to catch on to what happened, and then they went crazy. I was donating money to the black to Farrakhan, and of course he didn't need my, he had plenty of money. $100 was nothing to him, you know. So, but it was sure, it was sort of showing him that I'm willing to sit down with the black separatists and make plans. And after that, I went all around the country meeting with black separatist groups. Unfortunately, I found that they're just not that dependable. You can't get them organized properly. Of course, it wasn't my job to organize them anyhow, but they just can't keep it together. Of course, they're not much worse than the white right wing. They can't keep it together either. But so anyhow, for instance, my son-in-law was working for a stock company in Indianapolis, and he's driving down the street one day. He comes to a stop sign. There's a guy selling the Final Call, the black their newspaper, and he opens the window. Now, my son-in-law was dressed fit to kill, driving a brand-new car, and he said, "I'd like a paper." And the guy, black guy, sort of looks at him, and he leans into the car, and my son-in-law says, "I'm Tom Metzger's son-in-law." "Oh, we knows the Mr. Metzger. Here you go. Thank you." So there, I'm known by the black separatists all over the country, and when I go on a black radio show, I get more positive calls for white for black and white separation, and I get less attacks on a black station than I do a white station.
So on that basis, there's a big movement among the blacks for black separation. In fact, there's a bigger movement among the blacks for black separation than there is among the whites for white separation.
Yes, there is, but unfortunately, it's not going anywhere at this time. However, I told him, if you want to attack Washington, you can attack him on your way, and I'll attack him my way, and then we'll make an agreement at the end. I have no problem making deals with separatists, no matter whether they're Mexican separatists or black separatists or what, as long as they understand exactly what I demand, and I know what they demand. And I think we're all going to sooner or later be attacking the central system in Washington myself. And I wouldn't, well, like when they had the black riots in L.A. Over these, that guy that was beaten up, I forgot his name now, but anyhow.
Yeah, Rodney King.
Rodney King. I went on the radio and said, look, if they'd have told me, asked me, I'd have brought them gasoline to help burn down the federal building. If you want to attack the Beverly Hills and the rich Jews and all those people, hell, go ahead. But just don't go into the white working class. If you go into the white working class neighborhoods and start killing people, we're going to kill you. You know?
Absolutely. Well, we've just run out of time, Tom, so I want to thank you very much for joining me again. Do you have any closing statement? Because we've got a few seconds.
Well, I don't know whether we said it last time. I went on, went to Israel, and it was an interesting trip. I had a good time over in Israel talking to all the Jews. The big shots didn't even know I was there, I don't think.
Yeah, it's that was an interesting story. So, okay, well, we'll wrap it up then. I want to thank you for joining me today, Tom. I want to thank everyone else for listening. And I'll be back with you all soon. Bye for now.
Thank you, Andy.
For Folk Radio Network. Andrew's book, The Synagogue of Satan, is now available on his website, andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com, in an updated, expanded, and uncensored edition.
2016, with our interview with Andy from Britain. And so we're going to be sending this out as a show. I think you'll like it. I hope so. There we go. Okay, now... we got that over there, that over there. That